Charles Vargas, and you're listening to episode 23 of the Art Scene Podcast. Before I introduce my guest today, I wanted to tell you about an event happening this weekend. On Saturday, October 14th, several Bay Area artists, in conjunction with Interface Gallery, are putting on an art sale to benefit the Puerto Rico Hurricane Relief. The Artists for Puerto Rico Benefit Sale will be happening from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. at 486 49th Street in Oakland's Temescal Alley. Former guests of the podcast, Nando Alvarez Perez, Luca Antonucci, and Whitney Lynn will be among the group of artists contributing work to the sale. In addition, Interface Gallery has announced that they will be collecting supplies for those who have lost their homes in the current fires in Napa and Sonoma counties. For more information, check out Interface Gallery on Facebook. All right, so as some of my listeners know, I have had on Luca Antonucci twice on the podcast, once to talk about his work with Copa Press, and another time to talk about the SF Art Book Fair. But Luca is only half of the team that makes both these ventures possible. The other half is made up by David Kasperzak, who is our guest today. I met up with David at Copa Press headquarters in the Mission District, and I got to hear him talk about his time growing up in Tennessee, the time he spent train hopping all over the country, and the multitude of art projects that he has taken on here in San Francisco. So without further ado, here's our conversation. All right, so David, I'm glad to be back in the basement again. I think this is my third time, I think.
Yeah,
I'm back.
I think so.
Yeah, and every time I see you, I always mention I have to get you on here. So fortunately, I was able to do that.
Yeah, we're excited to have you back again.
Yeah, and how are things post the art book fair?
Good. We thought we were going to have some downtime, and then we wound up picking up a really large job that started the day after.
Oh, really?
But that just finished last weekend, so this is kind of the first week we're getting to relax a little bit and work on some projects that have been on the back burner for a while.
Right, as we hear, like, all the machinery in the background.
Yeah, that's the guillotine cutting books that you hear in the back.
So, you know, this year, I went this year, and I went the year before, too. You guys had a big crowd. I feel like it was bigger than the year before.
It was, yeah. This year we had around 10,000 people.
Wow.
And last year was around 7,000 people.
Oh, that's a big jump.
Yeah, it was a nice kind of comfortable growth, I think, anything.
Yeah.
Larger than that. One day, Saturday, we had to start a line, which was kind of unfortunate, but...
And I should mention to our listeners, so David, you are the other half of Copa Press.
Right.
Correct, right. So, and Luca is the other half who I've had on, Luca Antonucci, who I've had on here before a couple times to talk about the SF Art Book Fair and his work. But we'll get down later to how you became a part of Copa Press. But the big thing I usually want to start out with is, where are you from?
I was born on Sanibel Island in Florida. It's a small kind of retirement and resort town.
Yeah.
Where Robert Rauschenberg is from.
Really?
And lived his whole life. But we moved pretty quickly from there to Knoxville, Tennessee. Well, outside of Knoxville in the Smoky Mountains area. And my parents were kind of helping out opening medical clinics in different countries, so we moved a lot in between there.
Were they doctors? Or
yeah.
Okay, both of them were doctors.
Yeah.
Basically up until you're 18, I assume you were in Tennessee that whole time?
Yeah, kind of back and forth between there and places like Haiti and Romania for a little while. But... Yep.
And that's part of because of your parents' job, like And were they part of like a nonprofit or something like that?
No, they kind of did it independently. My dad would get funding from all kinds of different sources, and he actually runs a walk-in clinic in the Smoky Mountains in Tennessee, and that is largely funded by Dolly Parton.
Really?
Yeah, it's very close to where she grew up and. She has a theme park called Dollywood.
Right. I've heard of Dollywood.
Which is literally built on the property that she grew up on.
Yeah.
And she donates 100% of the profits every year to the surrounding area, to schools and hospitals.
Wow.
Yeah. So.
How did your parents get into that?
I don't know. They were both doctors in Florida with private practices, and I think we're just like they were on the boards of hospitals and doing more and more admin stuff, and they got really tired of it. And my dad, I guess, had this like early midlife crisis where he's like, I need this is not why I became a doctor. Like, let's go work for free.
Well, I guess better that than buying a new Jaguar or something,
No,
right?
thankfully. He
Yeah.
actually, funny enough, some of his funding came from a friend who had a collection of 18 Corvettes and sold them.
Wow.
And he now runs a runaway shelter in Galway in Ireland.
That's interesting.
Cars were a big,
Yeah.
big part of people's lives in Florida, especially.
And so when you went to these other countries as well, how long would you go for?
Usually no more than about 6 months to a year at a time.
And you would go to
And
school there too?
yeah, we would just get kind of homeschooled.
Oh yeah. Well, yeah.
But then yeah, Tennessee, I was there through a lot of middle school and all of high school.
And your interest in art, was that always something constant throughout this time, or?
Yeah, for sure. Lucky or unlucky I never really thought about doing anything
Well,
else for as long as I can remember.
right. I mean, I one of my best friends from college, both his parents are doctors. He
Oh
became a
yeah.
doctor. I mean, even his
Yeah,
yeah, and even like his brothers, like in med did was did medical sales, was a
Right.
business person.
No, they were always super supportive. They actually said the only thing you shouldn't go be is a doctor.
Really?
Yeah, I think they're both pretty tired of the medical system in this country, but it's not much better in other countries as we think it is.
Yeah.
It has just different problems.
So they were really supportive of whatever decision you wanted to be make
Yeah,
in terms of your
totally.
career.
I mean, I left. I finished high school a little bit early, and I wound up hopping freight trains for a while.
Really?
And they were just kind of like, "You have a place to stay. We can't help you out other than that. So good luck."
Were they that chill about it a little bit, or?
I think it worried my mom a little bit more, but she was pretty good about not letting on. They both come from really large families in Boston and Philadelphia, and they were the only two
Right.
of their families to move literally off like a 5 block radius,
Wow.
and move away from that. So I think they get my wanderlust
Right. And I
and
guess they wanted you to get that world
leaving the
experience, eh?
nest. Yeah, so.
All right. So how many years? So you graduate from high school and you say you're going around on
Yeah,
trains instead of just
yeah,
jumping.
yeah.
So how long are you doing that for?
Off and on for about 2 years, I guess.
And how is that? Like, what is that life like?
It is either the most incredible thing you've ever experienced or the worst thing you've ever experienced, just given the day. It really ranges pretty dramatically.
Yeah, and what did you do for work during that whole time?
We would occasionally pick up jobs in different towns that we were in, but we tried to do as much just through trade as possible.
Yeah.
A friend that I was with was a really skilled carpenter at the time, and we would help people build things or mow lawns. But a lot of it was just dumpster diving and
Yeah.
subsisting off of
Yeah.
lease, I guess, basically.
So when did you get to a point where you're like, I'm done? I'm like.
Probably earlier on than but I mean, I was taking breaks in between. I was applying for college and
Yeah.
still trying to maintain some connection to real life, I guess.
Like you would come home and visit or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, anytime we were on a train that came through the southeast or that area, we would stay with my parents. I brought a lot of strange people home
Yeah.
for them.
Yeah.
One of them wound up getting really sick. We were taking a hike one day, and he just kind of collapsed. And I brought him back, and my dad went and checked him out at his office and was like, either he has leukemia or HIV, or he has both strep and mono at the same time.
Holy shit.
And he wound up having both strep and mono at the same
Oh,
time.
yeah, I guess that seems to.
And wound up living with my parents for several months because he couldn't
Really?
go anywhere.
Wow.
And so everything in the house had his name written on it so no one else would use it.
Well, so when you decided to go back to school, what were you thinking at that point? Were you thinking any school that was a good school and you would get education, or you were determined, I got to go somewhere where I'm going to pursue art?
I was always thinking about art school.
Yeah.
And always had the intention to go. I think I had not necessarily the most conventional childhood, but a very like comfortable and safe one.
Right.
And I think like when I graduated high school, I had a lot of friends in high school that weren't that way. And I started feeling guilty about it and being like, oh, this is not real life. Like I need to go
like
suffer.
Yeah.
And it's really silly to say in hindsight. And I think I realized that on the train trips that I was just kind of postponing the inevitable or trying to be
right.
Find authenticity somewhere that wasn't necessarily viable in what I was doing too. I was also didn't need to be on trains and wasn't forced to live that lifestyle and was kind of pretending to be like some of the hobos that had been doing that their whole life.
Right.
So that was kind of just as false. But I learned lots of amazing things, obviously, along the way.
Yeah, I would assume being on the road so much, you meet so many different people, yeah. See so many different communities. And
yeah, and that's something that I've tried to maintain throughout my life and career and anything I do. And it's part of the reason I have so many visible tattoos. At a certain point, you can't really hide that other side of yourself or sure. That past life of yourself.
Yeah.
I feel like you can put on a tie and be academically astute, and if you have tattoos on your hands, people know there's still something else that is invisible there.
Yeah.
It seems to be alarming to some groups of people and disarming to others.
Yeah.
And I kind of like riding that line between.
It's disarming for me if I see someone like suit and tie and all of a sudden one day like, oh, let me roll up my sleeves real quick.
Yeah, yeah.
And I see Taz, I'm like, oh, you know what? This guy's cool.
Yeah, it's become pretty common, obviously. But
yeah.
I think I don't know. I guess this is skipping ahead, but I wound up getting a degree in curation.
And this is for undergrad?
This is in grad school. We can come back to that, but in undergrad, yeah, I wanted to go to art school, and I had been introduced to the Bauhaus by a teacher in undergrad or in high school,
mm-hmm.
and I was really kind of interested in their philosophy. And the school I chose was the Columbus College of Art and Design, which is, to my knowledge, the only Bauhaus school in the United States.
Yeah, I've never heard of it.
I think it's evolved quite a bit since I was there, but it was founded by a man named Carl Canzani, who was one of the Bauhaus artists and teachers. And so their philosophy is that almost anybody can be taught to be an artist through practice and rigor. And so it was kind of more of like an art boot camp than what some of my other friends at like Pratt or RISD or schools like that were experiencing. I'll never forget the first day we had this big general assembly, and Carl Canzani was still alive at the time. I think that was his last year. He was in his 90s, but he was talking about the courses, the foundation year, like what we were going to be doing. Some kid finally raises his hands and he was like, I hear you talking a lot about like design and practice and repetition but not much about concepts or conceptualism.
Yeah.
And he just looked at this kid and he's like, how old are you? He's like 18. He's like, what the fuck do you know about concepts? He's like, I'm here to teach you how to implement a concept should you ever have one later in your life.
Yeah, I guess that's what grad school for.
Yeah, and that I was like, okay, either this is going to work or it's really not. And so, but it was fantastic. We didn't have individualized majors. We had to study photography and video and design and architecture and drawing and painting and kind of everything.
Yeah, simultaneously. So you did everything, yeah.
Yeah. And in hindsight, that was, I mean, I never went to school again specifically for design, which is what I do a lot of the time now. And yeah. A lot of that was kind of left over.
What made you go to a school that was, you know, a design-centric, like, education? I guess not design-centric, but just...
I think more of the fact that it was kind of teaching you a little bit about everything.
Yeah.
And I wasn't particularly working in a specific medium.
Yeah.
In high school or anything like that. So it seemed like a good way to kind of experiment with all of them.
Sure.
While learning sort of practical, like, computer programs, for instance. Like, I would never sit down and teach myself Photoshop, but
yeah.
If I had to for a class, you know, like it, now I know it and can kind of expand on all of those things. Even something that simple, just being sort of forced to learn things the quote unquote correct way before you can go and break that and do things the incorrect way.
I guess before you become more conceptual, yeah. I guess, right?
Yeah.
It's interesting to me that you came, your childhood for the most part, like your parents were pretty cool. They seemed pretty chill. They didn't seem strict, like strict parents is what it seems like to me.
No, they were, yeah, they were pretty, as long as we made good grades, they didn't really care what we were doing.
Right.
And that was kind of their litmus for everything else that was going on with us.
And you moved around a lot because of the work they did. And then when you got out of high school, you kind of did the same thing for a couple of years.
Yeah.
You kind of went off and, you know, you kind of did your own thing every day. Every day was different. Right. So it's interesting that then you went for undergrad.
Yeah,
you
I think I really needed some structure after.
Yeah.
After that, that's probably part of it. And
did you enjoy it?
I did quite a bit. I mean, it was definitely a shock the first semester. I think we lost about 60% of our class.
Wow.
Because they have a fairly easy admissions policy,
mm-hmm.
and then they just kind of beat it out of you.
Yeah. They weed them out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so that was kind of disconcerting. Like, all these people you started with are just like, I'm headed out. I'm done with this. I can't take another color theory class. I can't arrange rectangles on a sheet of paper anymore. They thought they were just going to come, like, draw anime and hang out,
right?
Go to parties,
right? Make posters, right?
Yeah.
So when you graduated, did you go straight into making art, and then just kind of thought of like being an artist?
I did. Yeah, kind of at the end of right before I graduated, I started working with some people who were kind of in the process of founding a residency program called the Skylab.
Mm-hmm.
In Columbus, Ohio, and I got really into kind of organizing exhibitions and running a space like that. Was still making my own work, but my own work was becoming more, I guess, curatorial in hindsight, more in sort of arranging and organizing people and larger events.
What kind of work were you making, though?
I was doing a lot of video work, that required lots of people's help, and a little bit of photography here and there, but like really large staged events and things like that. But while just also organizing sort of exhibitions, of people from around the area. And that kind of led into more of an interest in curation, which came actually quite a bit later.
How many years was it in between?
Let's see, I graduated undergrad in 2003 and started grad school in 2009.
Oh, well,
so yeah, a six-year gap, which I guess is fairly normal.
Yeah.
But yeah, and then after that, was just kind of traveling around, lived in New York for a little while, hated the summer there. Looked at the weather report and it was 60 degrees out here in August, and told my roommate I was driving out here. And
is that really what it was?
Yeah, and he said, "I'll come with you."
Wow.
And we initially had come out to, we were going to visit a friend in Seattle. Mm-hmm. And we stopped through San Francisco to visit another friend. And we got in a car accident at 16th and Mission.
That's not far from here.
Car got totaled. And so we were stuck here for about 2 weeks waiting for insurance to clear so we could get another car and continue the trip. And by that time, we had just decided we liked the city. And when the insurance money came in, we had enough for a security deposit on an apartment, and we just stayed. And I, until recently, haven't lived more than about 10 blocks from that intersection. Like, that was 12 years ago.
Yeah, you love this neighborhood. Yeah. I love this neighborhood. Yeah. I love this city. Let's stay. Yeah.
Maybe it's laziness. Like, oh, there's a place.
Well, I mean, you came in at a good time before it all, like,
blew fortunately, up and stuff. Yeah, I came in before.
And what were you, so then immediately did you go back to school or?
No, I initially was working for the North Face, the backpacking company. Well,
what were you doing for them?
I was doing design and like merchandising stuff for them. I had all through high school, I had worked for a big like kayaking and backpacking outfitter that a friend's dad had owned and led whitewater and kayaking trips and things like that. So it's something that growing up in the Smoky Mountains kind of had always stuck with me. And back then we would get gear sent to us from different companies to test it out and provide feedback to them or to use it on these guided trips and see what the other people thought. And that just led to me eventually getting a job here with North Face doing kind of entry level stuff for them. And that was awful. I had never worked in a company that large, and I think I very quickly realized that it wasn't for me, and also the people doing the design there, shockingly, like, I don't think it ever went hiking, or it was like, you know, somebody's son who's a fuck-up skateboarder and needed a job, and instead was like, okay, come work for me, you're designing tents now. But some of them went on to start A-Light, which is a really cool company based out of here.
Yeah.
Makes really nice stuff.
Wow. Well, I guess the corporate environment was
not for me. Yeah. Very quickly. I think I only did that about 6 months. And then I worked for the SPCA for 2 years.
Really?
Yeah, as a dog trainer and dog care attendant.
And did you grow up with a lot of dogs that you just...
No, I mean, yeah, we had animals here and there, but... no, it was just, I was looking for a new job and a friend of mine was like, you'd probably be good at this. You like animals. I was still pretty, hardcore vegan at the time. And I think that was always like a signal to anybody that, oh, you should work with animals.
Right.
So yeah, I did that for a while and it was, really challenging in ways you wouldn't expect. Obviously a lot of people took their work home with them.
Yeah.
Literally sometimes.
Well, you know, I've been to the one that's over here, the one
yeah,
near,
that's,
right?
That's
the big
where
one,
I was.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and yeah. I have never been to like an animal shelter that
it's
big.
It's fancy.
Yeah, it's like a 5-story building.
Yeah.
And then they had like off, it felt like a startup. Like a
yeah, yeah.
Up,
it's
and
always
people serious
been,
about their jobs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's always been larger than the rest of them. It wasn't quite so developed when I was working there, but it was kind of starting to head that way.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of controversy about that amongst the staff and
really?
The public as well. But yeah, it was an interesting experience, and I think I was one of 3 male employees in the entire organization.
Yeah.
And that was kind of amazing, actually, to just be sort of the opposite work environment that I would have almost anywhere else.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I did that, and then during that time I started working at a tattoo shop and learning to tattoo by just doing running the shop and general maintenance and stuff. And then grad school kind of came right at the tail end of that.
Well, and before you went to grad school, were you happier doing those other jobs than like those 6 months at North Face?
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think I can go back to that environment. I'm tempted every now and then, Luke and I sit down here and struggle to make the money when we have friends that work at Airbnb and are there like 10 hours a week and make 300% more than we do.
Yeah.
But they also, you know, drink for 4 hours every night.
They
so.
Do. They do. Yeah. So. Yeah, I have.
It's a trade-off, I guess.
A lot of my friends from undergrad. So I went to undergrad in San Diego, and a lot of my friends that I went to school with were all business majors.
Yeah,
and they all moved up here. Like, there's like a good 50 people I went to school with.
Wow.
That live here in the city.
Yeah,
and I run into them, and they all like were they're vest jacket wearing, yeah. like, and you know, they're Dockers and whatever, yeah, totally. And every single one of them. Work for like some tech company or some startup or whatever, and it's they drink so much, which yeah. I found out a
I
lot.
Mean, they like provided at work for you.
Yeah, they drink a lot, and but the, what was weird was how much their lives revolve around that job.
Yeah, yeah.
Like I can't hang out with one of them without them saying like where you want to meet up? Like, let's meet up at this bar. No. You know what? We have kegs tapped here at work, so you just want you come over
right,
to my work.
Exactly. Which is a really brilliant tactic by the companies.
Oh,
that
for sure.
Started that environment, like just make your employees not want to leave and take care of all of their outside chores for them, and they'll yeah. just work forever and not even realize it.
Yeah. Yeah.
But not that there's anything wrong with that either. No. I mean, some of those companies are necessary and.
Right.
They pay people well, it seems, and...
Yeah. I think it's the, I don't think for me, the same right. way as you, I want to go home at 5 or when I want.
Yeah.
You know, like,
yeah,
I don't want to be there.
And Luca and I probably work 7 days a week most of the time,
sure.
but it's at our own pace. And
right.
It's like,
right.
if friends or family are in town, we can just not come to work, and it's not disrupted. I don't have to email 15 people and
right.
let them know. It's constant, but at a less, like, frenzied pace, I think.
Sure.
Sometimes it's frenzied, too.
Yeah. All right, so now you're ready to go back to school again. And where do you end up going?
I end up going to CCA for the curatorial practice program.
And again, another school, I think, of the schools here. I remember when I was looking to go to schools up here, that was considered the most structured program.
Yeah. That I didn't even really know necessarily. It was just I had decided that I wanted to study curation, and there were basically two choices in the United States. It was either that or Bard in upstate New York.
Yeah.
And I already dealt with the summers in New York and wasn't going to go back to do that. So
by the way, it's not like you're from a place whose summers are not
no.
very cool. So
yeah.
that's interesting.
I think
that
I absorbed enough heat in the first, like, 12 years of my life to last me the rest.
Yeah.
It's just, yeah, the humidity. I'm not a fan. I'm built for the San Francisco weather, basically.
Yeah. So tell me about because I know this program is actually, it's actually renowned. It's a really good program.
Yeah, it's a fantastic program. I was convinced to go there by a curator named Kate Fowl, mm-hmm. who is British, and currently runs the Garage in Moscow, which is a large contemporary institution. And she also runs the International Curators Association. So she was someone that I had been kind of aware of already. And I met with her, and yeah, she kind of really sold me on it. And then I get to school, and I'm like, where's Kate Fowl? And they're like, oh, she left. You have Lee Markopoulos instead, which turned out to be one of the best experiences of my life, having her lead the ship there. Yeah, I always seem to find myself with very disciplined, authoritarian British women.
Yeah.
I apparently learn well in those scenarios.
So tell me, so now you're studying to basically be a curator.
Yeah.
And are you still making work? Because, you know, before I went to grad school, I went to museum studies program for
yeah.
the same reason. I wanted to be a curator at one point, and I was a photographer beforehand.
Yeah.
And I just remember that took up for 2 years, basically, that I didn't do any work.
Right. I definitely decreased in some ways, but I feel like I was just kind of building ideas for future
yeah.
works. And I definitely entered the program with the mindset of an artist more than a curator.
Yeah.
I was kind of interested in exhibitions as a medium themselves,
mm-hmm.
as something to be played with and experimented with, because they just had so many more parts than a singular artwork, and the work that I was interested in making all kind of had to be in these larger bodies to function, to make sense.
And tell me about that, because I have that same idea where I believe curation is an art form, and it can be an art form in itself. Yeah. And
very controversial topic.
I was gonna. That's what I was gonna.
Curatorial crowd.
Yeah, and I was gonna bring that up because I remember saying that at one point in a class, and I got ripped apart.
Yeah.
And but the person I kept citing, being a photographer, I cited Steichen.
Yeah, sure.
But the Family of Man exhibit.
Yeah.
And my big thing was like, that's a perfect way, like, to take aside all the messaging and the whatever, the propaganda of that show. I said, but just the elements, the architectural elements of that show, it's a pretty, he artistically presented that the photographs in that exhibit.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I was like, how is this not a thing anymore? Or, and then, you know, and I got back the whole, like, oh, you know, it's not.
And it's something Steichen's probably more remembered for at this point than his individual photographs.
Correct, yeah.
And yeah, that's what was exciting to me, was the history of exhibitions just teaches us so much more about the history of art and the history of the world than sort of any individual movement, analysis of a movement, or specific artists. I think you get sort of a socio-political snapshot of what was happening around the time of that exhibition. And, it's something I guess I make work like a curator, and I curate like an artist. That's probably the easiest way to put it.
Well, and I don't think it's a bad thing. I think that's
cool thing. I think it's all gonna continue to blend more and more.
Yeah.
And I think the division is important on an institutional level.
Mm-hmm.
But outside of that, I don't necessarily think the division is doing us any service.
So, like, when you get to the level of, like, a major institution like the SF MoMA or the Met or something,
yeah,
the
I division mean, you need is someone more dedicated full-time to just not concerned with their own aesthetics or their own production, but dedicated full-time to artists and artworks and the protection and care of them, which was the original job of a curator,
right?
Which I believe the word was first used in Greece to denote someone who was appointed by the courts as a caretaker of someone who was unable to care for themselves.
Yeah,
which is a really sort of pompous title to carry on now, and I think that's why a lot of curators or exhibition makers kind of got rid of that title. People like Harold Zeman, and have tried to make it more of a blue collar job in some ways.
Yeah. So you're thinking like this blend is more pertinent to like galleries or like community art spaces or arts like art community centers.
Yeah. Or things like the kind of large exhibitions, biennials. Independent, artist-run spaces have always kind of been my focus. I think outside of those buildings that have rules for a reason, at least most of the time, that separation can be necessary. Yeah, outside of that, I think some of the most interesting exhibitions I've seen have been curated by people who are kind of amorphous in their position. Writers sometimes, artists sometimes, curators sometimes. And I think that's going to kind of continue.
Yeah. So postgraduate school. So I made a list because I did a little research on you and I was amazed of like, which now after hearing the multitude of things that you've done prior to going to grad school and doing what you do now, I'm not surprised anymore, but I'll list a few things. Okay. And then I'll get to how you got to all of these.
Sure.
So you are part of a collaborative group, our group called Will Brown.
Right.
Okay, you're a partner here at Copal Press,
yeah,
with Luca. you co-founded and you co-run the SF Art Book Fair, the annual book fair. You teach graphic design at CCA, or you taught at one point.
Yeah, I still teach a. Actually, it's a class about exhibitions for a designer. The overlap there between the two.
And then on top of all of this, you still curate exhibitions and you make work.
Yeah, less on the curatorial these days.
So what came first of all these things, and what led, I guess, or what led to what?
So I guess first, after grad school, I got a fellowship working for the Wattis Institute and for the Caddis Foundation. And so I was at the Wattis half of the week and at Caddis the other half of the week. And I was working on exhibitions with Jens Hoffman at the time. And then two of my own at the Wattis during that time. And while I was at the Caddis, I was kind of helping them with collections things and interviewing people from their collections and organizing the weekly events and lectures and stuff they did. And during that is when I had known Lindsay White for a while, and I met Jordan Stein while in grad school. And Lindsay called me one day and said, hey, she was living in the back of a gallery called Triple Bass at the time, which is on 24th and Treat. And Triple Bass had been there for a number of years, maybe 6-7 years. And it had this sort of secret apartment through the back of the gallery, which they rented out, and I think is how they could afford to pay the gallery rent. And she said, Triple Bass is moving out, and the landlord doesn't want me to move out because he doesn't feel like finding a new tenant and having to renovate this whole space, so he's offered me the gallery space as well, and I told him I couldn't afford it, and he said, well, what can you afford? And he made it really reasonable. So she's like, what the hell do I do with this thing now? Like, and she had some ideas and I had some ideas, and then she brought Jordan Stein in, which I found out later is because she was trying to date him. and now does and has been for many years. But we sat down and talked about what we knew, what we didn't want the space to be. And that was another sort of quasi-commercial gallery, that really didn't have the time or resources to honestly represent artists and do a good job on their behalf. And at the time, I think some of them have kind of sloughed off, but at the time there were a lot of smaller spaces that were kind of secondary careers or secondary hobbies to what someone's other main job was. And it was great that there's people were active and things were being shown, and but I just don't feel like it ever did the artists much of a service, at least in advancing their career in some way. And there's also plenty of people that have wonderful galleries here and do a really good job at that and have the means and time to put into that. And we didn't. So we decided not to be a gallery or to sell work. And then we kind of took that a level further and said, could we be a space that, an art space that doesn't show artwork at all? And what does that look like?
Yeah.
Can we make exhibitions without artwork? Because we don't have any money or funding to ship things in or to necessarily create large things ourselves, or how can we make exhibitions without art, but all of the, include all of the sort of in-between stuff and all of the ephemera and detritus that surrounds the art world. And I think we were most interested in sort of the narratives behind the art world. Jordan works as a curator as well, and had at that point for a while. And I was increasingly getting tired of working as a curator, even though I had just kind of started. I realized a lot of the people that I looked up to and idolized were just kind of killing themselves to make it in this career. And that was kind of the level it was going to take to get
It's pretty competitive.
To what
too.
I wanted to do. Yeah, it's competitive, and I think, unfortunately, a lot of it has to do with where you started out, what your connections are from the day you were born.
Sure.
And not in every case, there's people that have come out of nowhere and become great curators, but it kind of costs money at the beginning to be a curator. You have to be at everything, you have to travel constantly, and no one's paying you
to do that for a while.
So it's just, even participating in that world on the level that you're supposed to be successful in it is expensive. And it kind of started to turn me off on the whole thing. And ultimately I realized the end goal was that I would get a job at an institution and make someone else's shows for 30 years before I got to start making my own. And it just seemed really backwards. So we had this rinky dink little space and just started kind of playing with exhibitions the way that we wanted to, and tried out things that we knew we would never be able to do in a larger institution for safety reasons or insurance reasons or legality. And our first exhibition was held in the basement of the space, and it was called Illegitimate Business, and it was an exhibition of objects that people had acquired illegitimately, sometimes outright stolen, sometimes there was a piece Chuck Close kind of print that he was getting rid of that someone who had worked for him pocketed on his way out instead of putting it in the trash like he was supposed to. Or there was an Andreas Serrano that was given to a friend's mother because he was having an affair with her and her husband found out. And it was kind of this apology of sorts. So it interested us. The more we talked about it, everyone we talked to had an object like that, like from a previous job or, and so we just kind of collected them from people, and the works were all shown anonymously without the owner's name involved, but we also posted the narrative of how they acquired the piece, which was really what was interesting, because some of the things, even though they were by Carol Walker, were not very interesting remnants of other works necessarily, but had these amazing stories behind them. And you could only see the show by coming down into our basement, which was partially tongue-in-cheek. We thought it would be funny if we opened a space and the first show wasn't visible from the street. It was just this empty gallery still. But also just we were worried about getting sued or arrested or something, and we did get one threat during the process, but it all turned out fine. But yeah, that kind of set the tone for the rest of our projects there. And we started doing a lot of programming. For at least a solid year, we were doing probably 5 events a week. And it was great. It was kind of a place where people could come and hang out and see the type of events that don't necessarily fit in a bar or a concert venue or an art museum. We did a reoccurring project called Comedy Drawing School, kind of after the comedy traffic school. Where we had comedians perform and the audience sat at easels and drew them like a figure drawing class as they were performing. And after the first one, some of the comedians came up and they're like, we were really worried that it was just going to be kind of too distracting or strange for them. And they were like, no, it's the opposite. Like, your worst fear as a comedian is that the audience isn't paying attention. They're just like doodling. They're not really listening to you. And it's like, now we know that's what they're doing. And all that pressure is off. And you could just kind of, and that I think was kind of a confluence of a lot of my previous interests and lives. You know, it was all coming out of our own pocket, and we just kind of had to scrape things together as we could. And a lot of that, Lindsay and I at least, both came from a really kind of punk DIY background in college and earlier, and all of those tools kind of came in handy. And
sure,
and doing this thing. And it was really, I think the best part about it was to be able to blend that sort of lowbrow aesthetics and interest sometimes with a more academic sense that we all had gradually developed through going to school and studying on our own, but also gaining the interest of the legitimizing force of the art world. SF MoMA participated in events that we did.
That's cool.
On multiple occasions, and we actually decided to close the space, I guess about a year ago now, 2 years ago now, when we were invited to come put on an exhibition at the Berkeley Art Museum, and actually the last exhibition that would be held in that space.
Oh yeah, the original building before it closed.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And went to the new one.
Yeah, and that was kind of a moment where we were like, well, how would this work? We've run this space kind of not against traditional institutions, but parallel to it, like just a little bit wrong off to the side. And now they're interested in bringing our model of exhibition making into the institution. What does that look like? And how do we kind of navigate that? And we realized at that point we could kind of continue to work in that way, and the space wasn't as necessary anymore, and that Wilburn could kind of evolve into something else. We've published books since, curated exhibitions, taught classes together at SFAI and CCA. And
yeah, so you guys still do stuff together.
We do,
just
yeah.
Not as concentrated,
yeah.
Right, yeah.
Which is kind of nice. I think we were both, or all three of us were trying to focus on our own paths as well. Jordan was increasingly doing more and more exhibitions for various institutions, and Lindsay was teaching full-time at SFAI, and her own art career was picking up more and more steam, and she needed to focus more on that. And myself, like, working collaboratively all of the time becomes a little exhausting, and you kind of need that individual outlet as well.
Yeah.
So now we all have time to kind of pursue those individual outlets, and then come together once in a while.
Which is still cool, because you can still apply whatever you've individually grown and learned.
Right, exactly. We're all
when you
kind
guys collaborate.
Just ravenously researching and reading things, and I'll get a call from one of them every now and then that's like, here's an exhibition idea that just came out of this random thing that I was looking at. And sometimes those develop into projects.
And then, so then tell me, when did you join COPA? Like, because I know you're not one of the founders,
no,
right?
No, Luca founded it with Carissa Potter Carlson, who's, what was that, 5 years ago? Six
Seven
years
ago?
Now? 7 years ago, wow. That actually happened during the Will Brown storefront days. We had been invited to do a residency at the Headland Center for the Arts, and we were trying to decide what to do with the space while we were gone for 3 months, because it just, we always had this sense of urgency to never have the space empty.
Yeah.
Which is maybe perhaps why we burned ourselves out and did too many
You guys were ambitious.
Projects. We just like felt so lucky to have this thing in the
Sure.
city that was still somewhat affordable.
Yeah.
And that it just like not a second of it should be wasted.
Yeah.
So during that time, we invited Luca and Carissa to come operate COPA out of the space while we were gone. And they set up a sort of small bookstore and brought the Rizzo. And
so did you already know them through just by being part of the community?
I
you
met
knew
Luca
them?
Through his girlfriend, Sarah Hotchkiss, because we were in grad school at the same time. And then met Carissa through Luca. And had just kind of, followed some of the shows that they had been doing together and books they were putting out. And then after returning from the Headlands, I came to Luca with this idea. I had found a high-res PDF of the Xerox book
that
Seth Siegelob and Jack Wendler produced in the 70s, which is kind of one of the seminal art books. Artist books. And I was like, hey, I have a high-res PDF of this thing. We could just reproduce it ourselves and give it out, because at this point it cost about $4,000 or up for a copy of it.
Wow.
And then we were like, well, we should alter it somehow. Maybe we should like add ourselves in to the pages. And that sort of thankfully didn't stop there, but evolved into this idea of the Rizzo book series that we did together. It was our first project, which involved the same format, kind of 20 pages given to 5 different artists, and they would come and make the work on site on the Rizograph instead of a Xerox machine.
Yeah.
And we were just curious what that might look like today instead of the 70s and with artists that weren't just in New York, but in multiple cities, to see if there are any sort of similarities that came together through the production of it. And we wound up doing it in San Francisco, Los Angeles, Portland, New York, and Marfa, Texas. And through that project, it was kind of right at the end of when Luca and Carissa were parting ways to pursue different things. And yeah, Luca, I don't know that he needed me, but there was a vacancy in right. the Colpo seat.
There was a job opening.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
And, so right around the same time you were like with Will Brown, you guys were starting to do your own thing.
Yeah, probably like, halfway through those 3 years of Will Brown space.
What made you want to like go this to be like, you know what, I'm going to do it. Let's
I've always done design work kind of on the sides. Just there always seems to be an abundance of it.
Yeah. Well, it's a perfect fit for like the experience and the education you've gotten.
Right.
Where you were just, you went to a school, an undergrad that was you were learning every medium.
Right.
You went to grad school for curating, and it sounds like you were doing a mixture of everything that you've learned and still learning.
Yeah, I guess I have like commitment issues, it sounds like.
But you found it, but it's like, but you're committed to a job where you get to do all those things.
Right,
that
right.
You couldn't decide which one to do with, stick with.
That's the goal, I guess, in general, is, yeah, to try and like synthesize and create your own profession to a certain degree.
Yeah. Well, I also think it's the future of art, right? I mean, yeah, more and more it's becoming conceptual. So. Let's mix and match. Nobody's really just a photographer anymore.
Right,
an art, just a sculptor.
There's this joke that all photographers that go to grad school become sculptors and vice versa.
I learned that firsthand. That's so true. Yeah.
I love it. I've watched it happen a couple of times.
Yeah.
And sometimes photographers become the best sculptors and vice versa. But yeah, I had already been kind of doing design on my own, and I've always been obsessed with art books and collected books, and it was just kind of a natural. And during grad school, I was thinking a lot about, I was constantly going through exhibition catalogs, but also was studying sort of exhibitions that had taken place as books in book form.
Yeah.
Like the Xerox book being one of them.
Yeah.
And yeah, just publishing and art publications had always been something that I was interested in, but I think, yeah, at the time I was really kind of had just been reading and studying a lot about them. And here came this kind of opportunity to start making. So
yeah,
I had made, you know, zines a lot as a kid. And that it's kind of the nice part of Colpo that it's just maybe a slightly more grown-up version of that. Not even grown-up, just we have a little more resources than I had then. It kind of feels the same as just coming down here and cutting and pasting things together.
Sure, yeah. Well, and it's cool because it's like, it's your place of business, but also like your own like workshop really to work on stuff, on ideas that you have, right? Yeah, and you make work and sell some of the work through under the Colpo Press like banner sometimes, right? Because I bought some work from you, like or from like, at the SF Art Book Fair.
Oh yeah, yeah. Right, some of the prints and sort of more design related things. Sure. Yeah.
And you have the basketball court looking prints.
Yeah. That you made this series. I'm working on a new one.
And are you a basketball fan?
Yeah.
Okay.
We're both big basketball fans.
Like college basketball or NBA basketball?
I like both, but I follow NBA more now. You follow NBA more. I used to follow college a lot more.
I was going to ask because you're from Tennessee. Yeah. It's big
out
there.
Yeah, being in the South, it's... Yeah.
Yeah.
And Tennessee doesn't have a professional team.
Yeah.
So it's the Vols that you watch. But even before then, in Florida really is when it started. I played basketball a lot, and my father was a doctor for different teams and tournaments, and worked with the Miami Heat for a little while, so I really? Got to see a lot of it, and it was often high school and college that we were going to see, and had friends actually from elementary school that went on to play in college and the NBA, and so, but yeah, I fell out of love with it for a while. I feel like it had about a 10-year period where it just wasn't as exciting, or it had gotten kind of corrupt. And then I think moving here, just kind of falling in love with the Warriors like everyone else, kind of made it all fun again.
I'm from San Diego, so our teams suck. You know, it's one of those, but I haven't given up. Well, maybe
always happen.
Yeah, right. It can always happen, but I never had a basketball team.
30 years for the Warriors.
Yeah. And I never had a basketball team, so I moved up here. I said, hey, the Warriors are a lovable loser team. Yeah, I'm used to lovable losers. And then, like, within
and
2 years.
Tickets were free for a while. Right. You could go to see the games for free.
And within 2 years, they, like, became successful. People were like, oh, you're
a bandwagon. And then you immediately got pegged as a bandwagon.
It's like, I'm from San Diego. I had no team. So, all right, so career-wise, I mean, you seem pretty set right now. Like, you seem pretty happy, right, for what you're at,
You're at. I mean, happy and set.
I mean, it sounds like a pretty cool game. I mean, it sounds to me like you found a perfect job that really encompasses a lot of your interests.
Yeah, no, I'm very happy with it all. And it takes a lot of kind of piecing things together, teaching jobs and... Tulpa and occasional art sales and things like that. It all kind of adds up to be, it's somewhat livable.
And where do you see yourself, like, you know, in a few years from now? Like, do you still see yourself still chugging, you know, obviously still working at Copa, but like, do you have any desire to end up working, not necessarily at a big institution, but like running some sort of like a YBCA or like a small art institution that's community based?
No. I think I'm somewhat done with the organizational role, or maybe I just need a break from it after.
Yeah.
There were periods during the Will Brown storefront where I was curating shows for Pilatus, Will Brown, and myself, and there would be three or four of them opening in the same month, and it kind of really became a unhealthy. But no, now I get to take more time on things and be kind of a little slower about it all.
Yeah.
And kind of I'm more focused on my own art making practice, kind of returned to making objects again and not quite so ephemeral in my practice. So. Yeah.
And you love the Bay Area, so
I do. I love the Bay Area, and it's really challenging right now, like everyone says. But I think in the last year, it's taken a turn for the better.
Yeah,
I've noticed, and people have kind of stopped complaining about the tech industry and this invasion, and just started to kind of work around it or work with it, and found ways to just keep going, and that's been really encouraging. And
Luca's right over there, but you have no interest in going to another city?
Oh, always. I mean, I think we both do. I always think I want to leave, and then usually it just means I need to go travel for a while.
Yeah,
and
get it out of your system.
Kind of content when I come back.
Yeah.
Honestly, I don't know where else I would move to in the country.
Yeah.
I could think of many other countries I would. In the U.S., I mean... LA is kind of the only logical thing, but it's so close. I'd rather live here and participate in LA than live in LA and participate in San Francisco.
Yeah.
So So yeah, for now, I'm here. But I think about leaving all the time. Not hard enough to do anything about it, obviously. But yeah, we've been fortunate enough to travel quite a bit in the last couple of years.
Yeah, so that helps.
And that's really helped. Yeah.
Yeah.
I was living in Sweden last year for several months, and then had a great time there, and was happy to come back here for about 3 months, and then was ready to.
It was like your sabbatical. Sabbatical.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I'm just always going to be restless like that to a certain degree.
Yeah.
But.
Which, you know, now after hearing your childhood, I mean, it sounds like it's natural for you to want to, like, take a little trip and go somewhere for a little bit and come back.
Yeah, I think a lot of people are that way.
Yeah.
There's a lot out there to see.
Right.
It almost, like, it gives me anxiety sometimes. Right. Like, knowing that I'm not going to be able to see all of it.
Yeah.
There's corners of the world that I will die and know nothing about.
I do have that too sometimes. Yeah. My family, my dad was in the military. So growing up, we moved around. Yeah. We moved a lot to different states.
Yeah.
And out of habit, my parents always had a road trip every year in the summer where we went to some random town that we never knew or heard of.
Those are the best.
Yeah, and so I still love doing that. Yeah. I think I do that more than I would. I don't. I barely.
The West out of the is country. Such a good place to do that.
Oh yeah, sure, for sure.
I just recently, my girlfriend and I drove to Montana, and kind of stopped at a lot of the parks along the way. Spent some time in Yosemite and Salt Flats, and yeah, it was great. It was definitely a nice kind of cleansing for a while.
Yeah. Well, Matt, well, thanks for coming on, dude.
Of course, I really
appreciate it. And yeah, you have an interesting life. I'm excited to share this.
You made it sound that way.
All right. All right, man. Well, thanks for coming on. And of course. Do you have
thanks
anything?
For having me.
Yeah, do you have anything coming up that you want to plug or anything like that on your end or Copal Press end?
Yeah, and I'm in a show at the Contemporary Jewish Museum that opens on September 27th.
Oh, what's the show called?
It is called The Artist as Magid.
Oh, yeah.
They actually changed the title recently. That's now the subtitle. It is now called Jewish Folk Tales Retold.
All right.
Subtitle, Artist as Magid, which is a Jewish storyteller.
All
right. It's a group show of artists. We were given a book of folk tales and asked to choose a story and respond to it and work.
All right, man. Well, thanks for coming on, man.
Of course. Right. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks again for listening, everyone. And thanks again to David for coming on. If you want to learn more about David's work, visit copalpress.com or follow Copal Press on Instagram at Copal Press. Visit the Contemporary Jewish Museum's website at www.thecjm.org to learn more about the show David will be in titled Jewish Folk Tales Retold, Artist as Magid. Be sure to subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts and please leave a review. It'll help spread the word about it. Finally, you can follow the podcast on either Instagram or Twitter at ArtSceneNPC. All right, till next time, everyone.